This is the Paranormal Podcast with Jim Harrell.
Welcome to the Paranormal Podcast. I'm Jim Harrell. So glad to be with you once again. And a couple of quick notes before we get started. First of all, you may notice during this interview, I reference the fact this is the 300th episode of the Paranormal Podcast, when in fact, you know by downloading it that it's the 301st. We had preempted this show last week to replay the interview with the late, great Jesse Marcel Jr. Obviously something we didn't expect to have to do, but we did. I hope you enjoyed that show, and we certainly thought it was a fitting tribute to his memory. So this is, in fact, the 301st show, in spite of what you're about to hear. And thank you for sticking with us for all this time. And I want to thank some other special people. I want to thank Phyllis, Benjamin, Jennifer, Angela, Deborah, Heather, and Lloyd. Since the last time we met here, they joined the Paranormal Plus Club. And if you want to see why they decided to access it, access hundreds of archive shows of this program, archive shows at the campfire, hundreds of exclusive podcasts you can't get on the free feed. If you want to find out about that, go over to jimharrell.net and click on the big green button. And the good news is that you will get $10 off. Yes, $10 off a yearly membership if you join during September and use the coupon code SEPT13. That's SEPT13. We also have a great class coming up towards the end of September with Michelle Belanger. We're going to talk about history and the occult, maybe how some historical figures were far deeper into the occult than you ever knew. And I think you'll enjoy it and enjoy all those video classes that are archived over there, and as well as the live one we're going to be doing with Michelle at the end of the month. Check it out. It's all over at jimharrell.net, and click on the big green button. And with that being said, let's get on to this show. We're going inside the real Area 51 with Tom Carey. Here it is. Our guest today is Thomas J. Carey, and I can't wait to get to this. As I said in the intro, this is our 300th Paranormal Podcast episode, dating back to 2005. So it is a special show, and I think we've really gotten a great guest and a great subject today, because the book that Thomas has written, it's a sequel to his bestseller, Witness to Roswell. He was on the program a few years ago. And it's called Inside the Real Area 51, The Secret History of Wright-Patterson. So really, everybody, particularly us, has been paying attention to Area 51 out in the Southwest. And maybe we should have had our gaze eastward. Let me tell you a little bit about Thomas before we get started. He holds a master's degree in anthropology and is an Air Force veteran who held a top secret security clearance. He has spent the last 22 years investigating the Roswell incident and has published more than 35 articles about it. He's appeared as a guest on many, many radio and TV shows and contributed to a number of Roswell-related documentaries. Tom and his wife Doreen reside in the Huntington Valley, Pennsylvania area. Thomas, welcome to the program.
Nice to meet you, Jim.
Yes, yes. Well, I have to ask you, everybody else, particularly with this disclosure from the CIA that Area 51 really exists out in the Southwest, everybody's like kind of been painted.
Right?
What did you say?
Like we didn't know already, huh?
Exactly, exactly. That was a revelation. But nevertheless, everybody's been paying attention to Area 51 out that way. But you and your co-author, Donald R. Schmidt, say the real Area 51, the thing where there's some really high strangeness that's gone on, is in my home state, the state of Ohio, Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Dayton, Ohio. Why did you guys pick up on this?
Well, Jim, the original Area 51, although it wasn't called Area 51, was Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. It's where all of the Roswell books, if you've read them, they all leave off where the wreckage was and the bodies were delivered to Wright Field in Dayton, Ohio. And that's, even our books more or less end there. And we wanted to pick up what happened to the wreckage and the bodies and the other UFO material that came after Roswell in 1947. What happened? Where, what happened there on the base? Did it just disappear, or just what? Roswell, as you know, Jim, is a term that's known around the world. You can go to the Ukraine and say Roswell, and they will know what you're talking about. It's, oh, is that where that UFO crashed? Is that what, you know, the second most well-known term is Area 51. You say Area 51 and they go, oh, isn't that where the UFO stuff is? So there's a connection between the two as far as being well-known. And the thing is, before there was Area 51 and all of the secret goings on there, there was Wright Field or Wright-Patterson Air Force Base where we know the stuff was taken before it ever went to, if it did, ever went to Area 51. Now, last week, last week, I guess it was the CIA finally admitted that, yes, indeed, Grandma, there is an Area 51. Well, we knew that. We've all known that for years. The question I would have is, okay, why are they admitting it now? I don't know the answer to that, but it's interesting that they are now admitting it. I know during the mid-1990s, during the Clinton administration, there was a lawsuit brought by people who lived in the area and maybe some of the people who worked at the base for hazardous material injuries, as they would call them, hazmat injuries, where they filed suit against the government. And all of those cases were settled very quietly. The Clinton administration did admit that there was a location there, but they never used the term Area 51. The cases were settled. Yes, there was an area there, and they settled these cases, these personal injury cases, and we never heard any more about it. So it is interesting why they've decided last week to confirm that, yes, there is an Area 51. They never admitted to anything along the lines of, you know, aliens or alien craft, things like that. What Area 51 originally was, and I'm talking about the Nevada site at Groom Lake and Section S-4 specifically, what the base was originally commissioned to do was to design or at least test secret high-altitude spy planes to fly over the Soviet Union.
U-2, for example.
U-2, that was the first project, was the U-2. And that was in the mid-1950s. In 1955, I believe, the base was commissioned. And that's where the U-2 was tested. That's where they called it the A-10, I believe, or AX-10, the Oxcart, which became the SR-71 Blackbird.
Yes.
That was tested. I believe that's where the B-2 was tested, the Spirit, the stealth bomber, the stealth fighter, the F-111 Nighthawk. And the reason it was chosen was because that it was so located way out in the desert on the northeast corner of the former atomic energy atom bomb test range where they used to test the atom bombs in the early 1950s. I remember seeing one of those tests on TV. It was almost like it was a reality show. They tested the atom bomb. And everybody thought, oh boy, isn't that great? But Area 51 is a location on the map. That's what it's called. It's near Groom Lake, and it was chosen for its remoteness and flat surface for taking off and landing high-performance aircraft in the mid-1950s.
Now it's interesting to me, though, as you said, and I think this is really important, is the government admitted it exists, but as far as anybody who posits that there might be anything other than testing going on there, like interaction with some aliens or artifacts and so forth, you'd essentially be laughed at and you'll be told nothing to see here. And sometimes I wonder if you don't, it's like pressure in a valve. The government will let off a little steam so something doesn't explode, but they would never admit the real juicy stuff. If there is alien experimentation going on alien bodies or recovery or reverse engineering of some technology, they're not, even if it exists, they're going to say it doesn't exist. So really, yes. What are they disclosing? They're not really disclosing. I mean, we had Annie Jacobson on, who wrote the very large book on Area 51 just in the last couple of years. And everything, you know, we already knew all this. So they're really not telling us anything.
Yes, they're giving you not even half a loaf, hoping that it will send you happily on your way. And that's what they're doing. And as you know, Jim, the Area 51 did not come into the parlance until the late 1980s, when a fellow by the name of Bob Lazar came forward. He claimed to have been a technician working at location S4 within Area 51, working as an engineer on back engineering alien technology. Now, Lazar, to look at him and listen to him, you say, boy, this guy is really sharp. The problem, though, is that his bona fides or his background check did not check out with what he claimed. His, you know, his education, his prior work experience, none of that checked out. So I know there's people who swear by Bob Lazar and others, and I would put myself in the dubious camp. I don't know. I could be convinced either way, but so far the evidence looks like that, you know, if you don't check out, you know, in a court of law, you're toast. But that's where the alien connection came. Then they started up the little alien out there, and people go out there and look around, and these government vehicles stare ominously down at them, like, and there's signs. Extreme measures or extreme force is authorized if you cross this.
Right.
Things like that make it look very ominous. But right now, I can be convinced either way. I am neutral on Area 51, the Nevada Area 51, let's call it.
Now, I know that you want to get to the real Area 51.
Real.
We'll do that right after this message on the Paranormal Podcast. I'm excited. I've told you about this coming up, this event, and I got to tell you, it's going to be a great one. I hope you can attend. I'm going to be there. It's October 17th through the 20th. It's the Paradigm Symposium, and we have a couple of great guests in this segment to talk about it. I'm talking about Scotty Roberts and Micah Hanks, the brains behind the Paradigm Symposium. Gentlemen, this is going to be great. Give me the update. What's the scoop that's going on with the Paradigm Symposium?
Well, let me first amend one thing. Micah is the brains. I'm just the pretty face.
Oh, I see. Okay.
I don't know if I want to lay claim to that. You can call me a form of consciousness behind the Paradigm Symposium. There we go.
There you go. The higher mind.
He is the Mr. Spock, the commander, the logic, the brain. I'm Pinky.
Now, this is going to be a potpourri of a bunch of stuff and some fantastic speakers. Talk to us about who all's going to be there and what exactly, if people missed it before, what is the Paradigm Symposium?
Well, Micah, why don't you tell him what the Paradigm Symposium is, and then I will go into the guests.
That's funny. He usually does that. He's flipping the pancake on me.
The old switcheroo.
Oh.
That's okay. The Paradigm Symposium is this is our second annual Paradigm Symposium, and it's an event that Scotty and I kind of, you know, hatched together that grew out of working on Intrepid Magazine. Intrepid Magazine, of course, is that really is Scotty's brainchild. And this is a magazine that really features a wide range of different subjects, everything from politics, you know, and news and timely things to UFOs, spirituality. And Scotty approached me a while back and said, you know, I would like to do an event that would feature some of the writers from Intrepid Magazine and that would feature these sorts of subjects. You know, would you be interested in helping me plan something like this? And I said, well, you know, as long as my heart will allow me to do that, I will. And along with a fantastic guy named Gary Evans this year, and don't worry, folks, my heart is in fantastic condition. But you have to have a lot of heart and trust, but we put a lot of it into this. But along with a fantastic guy named Gary Evans, based out of the UK, and a lot of folks who are attendees of conferences around the world, you may know Gary. He's one of the best in the business. But Gary's been helping us coordinate this year's event. And it is, I think, truly one of the very best alternative conferences out there. But it doesn't just feature alternative speakers, and it doesn't just feature fringe topics. We have people from all across the spectrum, you know, ranging from what might be alternative historians, but nonetheless tenured professors, you know, such as Dr. Robert Schock, who would be one of our key speakers this year. We've also got P.Z. Myers, and P.Z., of course, is an evolutionary biologist and a hardcore skeptic. And so a lot of people look at us and say, why are you doing that? Why are you mixing this up so much? And then you've got Nick Redfern and Breedy Jones and people like that in there, Chris O'Brien of the Paracast. And I say to people, what you have to understand is that we want to cater to a large demographic, and we are not looking for necessarily answers or debate. We are looking merely to educate. And when you come to an event like Paradigm Symposium, one thing is for certain, with the guest or the list of guest speakers that we have and with the range of topics being discussed, you will learn something, and you very well may change your perspective and outlook on life.
Now, I know, Scotty, you've got more to add about the guests, but I do want to say this, and something I'm looking forward to. I've been doing this show for 8 years now, but have not been able to meet a lot of these authors that I've talked to for all these years. So there's something about meeting somebody in person, whether it's a speaker or whether it's your fellow attendees. And I think from these types of conferences, you can build lifelong friends and people who are like-minded. And I think that's an important part that we forget about, because in our internet age, we can see everybody, we can see video, we can send emails, we can instant message, whatever. But not to be lost in this is the people aspect, getting to commune with like-minded folks.
Well, would you rather have a friendship or a relationship with somebody over the internet where you can look at them on a webcam and type messages to them and so on? Or would you like to be with that person, to be able to see them physically? That's what this is all about. I've had people ask me, say, are you going to broadcast this on Skype? And I said, well, no, we're not, because you can talk to people anytime you want on Skype, right, via technology. This is being there. It's like sitting at the feet of Socrates. You know, it's got that you're in a small arena and you're listening to these people speak, and they're presenting, you're interacting with them. And not only do you get to listen to their lectures, you get to go up and interact with them on a personal one-to-one basis. We've got Robert Bovall. How many opportunities do you have to get to shake Robert Bovall's hand and ask him questions face to face and listen to him speak? Robert Bovall, of course, he's an author. He's an Egyptologist. You've seen him on Ancient Aliens. You've seen him on just about every Egyptological documentary that's out there on the cable networks. Scott Walter, who is the host of H2's America Unearthed. He started off as a forensic geologist, and now he looks into all these different hidden mysteries, archaeological, historical mysteries in America. And Micah mentioned Robert Schock. We've got he's a professor at, I think it's Boston University, and geologist, geophysicist. We've got L.A. Marzulli, who wrote the best-selling Nephilim trilogy and is also working on the Watchers series on video. Dr. John Ward, who is a co-author of mine on a new book, and also he is a British archaeologist living and working in Luxor, Egypt, and he's going to come and bring his expertise from there. Nick Redfern, we all know, the prolific Nick Redfern.
He'll write two or three books during the course of the conference. I'm
yes. I'd like to say during this conversation, he's probably 10 to 72,000 words.
There you go.
Yes. I digress. Go ahead.
David Weatherly, who wrote the
Black Eyed Kids, yes.
He's got a new book out. Strange Intruders is coming out at the same time. Laird Scranton, very well known for his work on the Dogon. And he wrote a book last year on Velikovsky, and I can't remember the title of it. He's got a new book coming out. He's talking about cosmology and what we can learn when we compare ancient traditions. We've got Anthony F. Sanchez, who wrote UFO Highway, and we've got Dan Madsen. Now, Dan Madsen's a little different than some of the other speakers. He's the one who, in this group, that has taken things on more that fan base level, but he started as with you, Jim, and you, Micah, and everybody else that's on the speaker list. He's one of those guys that went took his curiosities into Star Trek and into Star Wars and Lucas. Mm-hmm. He was a publisher in all of these different areas, Star Trek, Star Wars, Lucasfilms, Lord of the Rings, and he's coming to talk about his experiences. We've got Marie D. Jones and Larry Flaxman. We're all very familiar with their work. Thomas Fusco, who wrote Behind the Cosmic Veil. Christopher O'Brien. From the Paracast, and he's talking about his stalking the herd, unraveling the cattle mutilation mystery. Dr. John DeSalvo, who founded the Giza Research Association, he's a physicist and a biophysicist, and he wrote a lot about the crystal skulls. He actually has some of the documented crystal skulls that he brings to the show. Micah mentioned P.Z. Myers, evolutionary biologist at the University of Minnesota, skeptic. Atheist, crusading atheist. He's coming to deliver a very different message than a lot of these people, but it's going to be good for everybody to hear them. And of course, Micah Hanks and myself, we will also be there.
And it's a great lineup, and I'm looking forward to it selfishly because a lot of these people I have interviewed, but as I said, I've never had a chance to meet them, so it'll be a great deal of fun. So I think now is the time we talk about who, what, where, when, the logistics. I know time is growing short, guys. October 17th through the 20th at St. Paul, Minnesota at the historic St. Paul Union Depot. So I know we're getting close. So how do people get in on this before it's too late?
Well, that is 6 weeks out from this coming Thursday is when we start. And people can go to the website and get tickets. That's just simply ParadigmSymposium.com. Scroll to the bottom of the page and you'll see all the ticket packages we have. And also, and this is only running until the 4th of September, midnight on the 4th of September. Well, actually, it'd be midnight, I guess, on the 5th of September, but 11:59 p.m. on September 4th, Wednesday, is the last day. We've got a 20% and a 30% ticket special running for the Labor Day weekend. And that ticket special, if you buy one ticket of any of the three tiers, you get 20% off.
Wow.
If you buy two or more tickets in any of the tiers, the bigger and the biggest tickets, you get 30% off each ticket. And
there
you'll want to move fast. And by the way, that biggest ticket, that all-inclusive, which gives you all the lectures, the dinner, the VIP panel discussion at the dinner theater style panel discussion, as well as the VIP cocktail party private where you can go meet these people and talk with them for a couple of hours, have a drink with them. All inclusive, there's only 14 of those tickets left. So you're going to want to avail yourself of these.
Yeah, certainly. Well, gentlemen, thank you both. I look forward to seeing you both there, and I look forward to seeing hopefully some members of our audience at the Paradigm Symposium, October 17th through the 20th. Check it out at ParadigmSymposium.com. We'll see you there.
Be sure to follow Jim on Facebook, Twitter, and Google+. Find all the links at JimHerald.com. Now back to the Paranormal Podcast.
The subject is the new book, Inside the Real Area 51, The Secret History of Wright-Patterson. We have one of the authors of said book, Thomas J. Carey. He's joined us, and now we're going to delve into the topic of Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. Now, as you laid out before the break, many of us are at least passingly familiar with Area 51, know that the U-2 spy plane, the SR-71 Blackbird and so forth were tested there. We kind of know the background and then also some of the lore about possible alien UFO involvement. But far fewer of us, we might know the name. I figure a lot of us don't even know where it is on a map. What is Wright-Patterson Air Force Base? Where is it? And what kind of role has it played in post-World War II Air Force?
Wright-Patterson Air Force Base is located just northeast of Dayton, Ohio, on a flat plain just northeast of the town. It was originally developed by the Wright brothers back in the early 1900s with their flying machine develop it further. They created an airstrip there, and things were going fine until World War I came along. The government co-opted the airstrip and Wilbur Wright Field, and ever since it has been military property. I won't go through all the name changes of the facility, but it makes your head spin just to try to follow those. But eventually, two airstrips were developed, one Wright Field and another Patterson Field. One was mostly supply, supply for the Army Air Force, and the other was technology development, intelligence and technology development. And it wasn't until 1948 that they were combined into Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. Now, this was with the when the Air Force became a separate branch of the armed forces. Until then, they were separate. There was a Wright Field and there was a Patterson Field. One was supply, one was intelligence.
It was the Army Air Corps before that, correct?
Yes. The Army Air Corps was actually part of the Army Air. You see, when we get into the name changes again, and your head, you can get a headache. I know I have trying to keep track of them. But in World War II, the Army Air Forces was divided into two main branches, the Army Air Corps, which was the operational combat arm, and then there was the another branch, which was administrative, et cetera, et cetera. Well, during the war, what is one of the things that happens is when the enemy has aircraft that is, performing well. You want to know what makes them tick. So we would have a captured Messerschmitt fighter or a captured Mitsubishi Japanese Zero. They would wind up at Wright-Patterson to be taken apart bolt by bolt to find out what made them tick for the purpose of improving our own aircraft to defeat them. And that's called back engineering. That's where it started. Was during World War II with the re-engineering Axis aircraft. So along comes 1947, and you have the Roswell incident. You have the crash, an apparent crash of we would call them a UFO today. Back in 47, they called them flying saucers. Where else would you take the wreckage to try to understand what it was made of and what made it tick? Wright-Patterson, because they already had the facilities to do that. So that's why the wreckage and the bodies were taken to Wright Field. It was right before the emergence of the Air Force into a separate branch. So it was Wright Field in July of 47. So not only the wreckage, but the bodies were taken to Wright Field. And they also had an advanced aeromedical facility there for biological investigation and handling of biological material. So that's why the bodies went there. Although there were some rumors that maybe a body or two went to, to Lowry Air Force Base in Colorado or in Denver, Colorado. And so that's why early on, all of the foreign technology, as they call it, Jim, this was in the Foreign Technology Division of the Air Materiel Command, which was commanded by General Nathan Twining at the time, went to Wright Field. So and for the next 35 years, this is where all of your so-called foreign technology and things coming in from outer space, whether they be Russian satellites crashing or crashing of unknown objects, perhaps of extraterrestrial design, would be considered foreign objects, foreign technology. So that's why they went to Wright-Patterson, the Foreign Technology Division. And we believe that at some point that the material and perhaps the bodies, we're not sure about the bodies, but the wreckage itself, Wright-Patterson divested themselves of that. They perhaps sent it to Area 51. We're not positive, but there are rumors that the material went to Area 51 in Nevada, which makes perhaps the Lazar story gives it let's put it a scintilla of credibility, but again, it doesn't make up for his background check failures.
Now, here's a question for you. you had mentioned at the onset of this that most books, including admittedly your own, previously had stopped at this point. Now, we're talking about a good period of time here, 65 years, if my elementary school math serves me. And many of the people who were involved in this have passed or you know, certainly in advancing years. How did you kind of break through where other books have failed to do so and get that next layer of information and detail?
Well, the way you break through, Jim, is not to sit on your rear end, but to keep shaking the tree. In our Roswell investigation, of course, we come across witnesses and family members of witnesses who passed who talk about the material at Wright-Patterson. Everybody that had an opinion on it or knew about it said that the material went to Wright-Patterson. So we already had a head start. And you do the same thing. You start calling family members, witnesses. One call leads to two witnesses lead to four. And that's how we developed the information, not only in Roswell, but on Wright-Patterson. Now, we had one other advantage. My co-author, Don Schmidt, was a personal friend and disciple of J. Allen Hynek, mm-hmm. who was mm-hmm. the Air Force's chief consultant for Project Blue Book. He was at the Ohio State University. And where are you? You live in Ohio.
I'm in the Cleveland area, actually.
Cleveland, okay. So Hynek was close by the Dayton, Ohio facility with Project Blue Book, and he became one of the chief consultants. So Hynek had a lot of information that heretofore has not been previously divulged anywhere. And this comes from Don Schmidt, who, as I said, was a personal friend and disciple and knew Hynek well. So a number of chapters deal with information given to Don by J. Allen Hynek. But most people know Allen Hynek by the swamp gas episode, where in 1965 or 1966, there were a lot of sightings in Michigan. And Project Blue Book dispatched Hynek to go to Michigan to find out what was going on there. And no sooner did Hynek get off the plane, he hadn't even been to one of the sites or interviewed anybody. And the press surrounds him, Dr. Hynek, what do you think it is? And Hynek says, well, you know, according to some of the stories, people have reported lights in swampy areas, and there's a phenomenon known as swamp gas, and that's all they heard was swamp gas. And they said, oh, we got swamp gas, and they all ran for the phones, and they didn't listen to the rest of the story. He wasn't saying that that's what it was. He said it was a possibility based on some of the information he had, and he became known as Swampy ever since, and it really upset him. And it set him on his trajectory of, switching sides. And he became a pro-UFO advocate based on the witnesses he interviewed, the depth of material, the stories, the evidence, testimonial evidence. He went from skeptic to an advocate that there was really a phenomenon there to be investigated.
So, there's been different apocryphal stories about presidents going to visit the bodies. Did you find any evidence for that?
Other than what you already know, Jim, I think there's a story out there of Eisenhower yep. meeting in, I believe it's Alamogordo, with a landed UFO that was prearranged. That's one of the stories. No, we do not get into that because that happened in New Mexico, and I believe that was in 1964. And other than that, the only stories I've ever heard about that have involved President Eisenhower.
So nothing at Wright-Patterson. Now, here's a question for you, and I've made this observation, and it's certainly not an original one, but I've talked to many UFO researchers, and I always like to ask this question because it's one that's particularly, being selfish, has fascinated me. I'm in my 40s, and when I was a kid in the 70s, we had a black phone that hung on the wall. We did not have a microwave. There certainly weren't any computers. There weren't any video recorders when I was a small child. And really, technologically wise, our lives have changed in the last 30, 40 years incredibly. I mean, if you compare technology, consumer technology, and just the way people lived in 1950, and look at it now, it's completely changed. Now, some would say some of that's not for the better, but that's not for me to judge. But it's certainly very, very different. And it seems like much of this technology came after the Second World War, and certainly right after the time things started to percolate after Roswell. Now, some people would say, Jim, this is because of the defense program and all the defense spending that was being done, research on technology, all of the different discoveries. We know the internet was originally a project of the U.S. military with ARPANET, and people would say also the space program. You know, although I tend to think of Velcro when I think of technological developments out of the space program. But nevertheless, from your evidence, is the kind of technological revolution we've seen in the last 30, 40 years, is it a product of the first things that I said, the space program, the defense program, or do you think that some of it or a lot of it comes from possibly reverse engineering of some type of craft?
Well, Jim, I used to be a non-believer in the in what you're advocating here, that anything came from the Roswell crash. Because one of the benefits, and you alluded to this, one of the benefits of war, unfortunately, it's a sort of a non sequitur there, but it's true. One of the benefits of war is that there are technological advances that come from wartime. I know some of the medical procedures that are ad hoc on the battlefield wind up as a standard practice in medicine, but they were emergency things that happened on the battlefield, and various metals to deflect, bullets and things like that. So I understand that, and I do believe that following World War II, there was a natural advancement of technology in certain areas. Things like the transistor is one thing, is one of those things that said, oh, did that come from Roswell? My understanding is that the transistor was already in development. There are those who will say, well, no, not really. It was only rudimentary, blah, 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 blah. But I'm prepared to cut the government slack on that and say, okay, the transistor and a few other things. But in the last few years, I've become convinced that there was a re-engineering project going on at Roswell, at least in certain areas. Now, you remember one of the well-known types of wreckage that was recovered at Roswell is a so-called memory metal.
Yes.
There was a lot of it spread around. You could take a piece of it, wad it up in your hand, and hold it over a flat surface, let it go, and it would flatten out right before it hit the flat surface.
Yes.
And thanks to one of our associates in Florida, Anthony Bergaglia, who took it upon himself to check out what happens to some of the wreckage that went to Wright Field, he found a project that was commissioned by the Air Materiel Command at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in 1948, right after the Roswell crash. They sent the project to Battelle Memorial Institute in Columbus, Ohio. Nice connection between Battelle and the Air Force over the years.
Mm-hmm.
And the project was to try to understand what made this memory metal tick. What was it made out of? What made it tick, and can we replicate it? Tony, it took him a couple of years, but he found the original reports written by Battelle Institute for the Air Force at Wright-Patterson regarding the research on the memory metal. And they found out that the major constituent, a major element of this memory metal was titanium. And what Battelle was trying to do was trying to find another element that you could make an alloy out of this to replicate the memory metal. And the closest they came was a metal, or an alloy that is on the market today. And you can Google it, once we get off the air, Google nitinol, N-I-T-I-N-O-L, and see what comes up. It's sold by the sheet and it's sold by the coil. but it comes from the Roswell crash. There's no doubt in my mind, because there was no previous history of tests or inquiries into this shape-shifting, morphing metal that we call memory metal. There was no history in the journals, the scientific journals, of any research in this area prior to 1948, when Battelle started their research into the morphing metal, the shape-shifting recovery memory metal.
And that sounds pretty close to a smoking gun.
It in my mind, it's a smoking gun. You're never going to get a picture of anybody shaking hands with E.T. I know. We have
despite what the Weekly World News has to say.
Yes, we have some critics who, oh, well, there's no documentation for this. We have critics. We have documentation for certain airmen at Wright-Patterson being where they said they were, when they said they were. And, well, it still doesn't prove that he saw E.T. Well, my answer is, well, they're not going to say so-and-so went to Wright Field to shake hands with E.T., that's not going to be on his record, and you're not going to have a photo of him or a video of him shaking hands with E.T. That's just not going to happen. So you can never satisfy the critics. It's a waste of time. So you have to go with the best available evidence and the preponderance of the evidence. And we believe in, as far as Roswell and Wright-Patterson, we have not only a preponderance of evidence that the wreckage and the bodies went there, but we believe it's a preponderance of the evidence beyond a reasonable doubt. And we've had lawyers tell us that if we took the case to court against the Air Force, we would win by a slam dunk. Our wow. position that this was really a crash of a foreign technology from off planet. So
now, that's fascinating, and maybe somebody ought to do that someday. Maybe you ought to have a recreation of a trial to try to prove that.
We've thought of that for a while now. It's just getting someone to actually produce, say, a show. To have a mock trial. The problem with that is the Air Force has no evidence. A trial, you have to present evidence for your position. They have none. They have no evidence, and we have a boatload full.
Now, let me ask you this. Obviously, you've been very steeped in the Roswell situation for a lot of years. Your first book is exhaustive. I'm looking at it over there on the shelf. I have the second book here on my desk. But how has doing this book and plunging into this set of data, how has it evolved your perspective on the Roswell case?
Well, my perspective on the Roswell case started I first read the Roswell incident in 1980 when the book came out by William Moore and Charles Berlitz. And up until that point, I was a UFO generalist. I was generally interested in the subject because I was just – it puzzled me about how these vehicles could outrun our latest jets. And I'm thinking, what are these flying discs that outrun our best jet fighters? I just couldn't get over that. And so when the Roswell incident book came out, you're talking about not just lights in the sky – things that don't, they're here and they're gone. You're talking about actual artifacts that are stored somewhere and alien bodies that are somewhere. So there you're talking about physical evidence. That's what struck me about the Roswell case. And my involvement early on in the case with Don Schmidt and Kevin Randall was the story that a group of archaeologists had stumbled upon the downed craft first. And they were allegedly from the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. And I live just outside of Philadelphia, and my background is anthropology and archaeology, so I thought I could help out in that area in tracking them down, which was my first involvement in the case. And since then, that was 1991, never thinking that I'd still be here talking to you today. I've been on the case for, 22 years now, and I'm still as enthused about the case today as I was back in 1991. I know a lot more about it, and I'm more convinced than anything. And, you know, the Air Force, you've got to, you can't fight something with nothing. And they have no case. And I know it's the Project Mogul theory, but when you examine it, it falls apart like a cheap suit. So, our mandate today is to find every last witness that's still alive until there are no more, or until we find physical evidence ourselves, because the fallback position, as you know, Jim, for skeptics is, well, show me a piece of wreckage. Yeah.
Right.
So,
well, barring that, this is really great information. It is inside the Real Area 51, The Secret History of Wright-Patterson. The authors joining us today was Thomas J. Carey, who wrote it along with Donald R. Schmidt. Can you tell folks where can they go on the net to follow your work with this book and everything else you do, and also where can they purchase the book?
You can follow us on the our website is www.roswellinvestigator.com. That's all one word, www.roswellinvestigator.com. You can reach me at T. Carey, that's T-C-A-R-E-Y, followed by the numerals 1947, T. Carey 1947 at AOL.com. And Jim, you should know that our book, Inside the Real Area 51, came out today.
Hey! August 20th. Now, we'll be releasing this on Monday, I guess. What day is that? That would be the 26th. So it will be obviously up and ready when you hear this. So congratulations. It's a really good book, as your first one was. And if you're interested at all in Roswell, you should get this book. Tom, thank you for joining us. Thank you for joining us today on the Paranormal Podcast.
My pleasure, Jim. I just want to say you can get it at your local bookstore or on Amazon, and it's in audio and Kindle. Is that what you say?
Yeah, Kindle. Yep.
Yeah.
I've got a book coming out on that as well, so I know exactly what it is. Yes, the Kindle. Thank you so much, Tom. I appreciate it.
My pleasure, Jim.
And thank you for tuning in to our 300th. Yes, our 300th episode. It's hard for me to believe, but there you have it, and I hope that we'll have at least 300 more. If you enjoy the show, please leave a rating over at iTunes, along with a little 2 or 3 sentence blurb. It always helps. We'll talk to you next time on the 300th and first edition of the Paranormal Podcast. Bye-bye. Now for the legal disclaimer. We do not accept money from publishers or content producers in exchange for interviews. However, as with most media outlets, in the majority of cases, we do receive complimentary copies of books and DVDs that we feature on our podcasts. Your purchases of books, DVDs, and other items via our Amazon.com links benefit Jim Harold and JimHarold.com and help us continue our programming. The sponsor messages you hear on the programs are paid endorsements, although we really do like them. For the full disclaimer, go to JimHarold.com, and thanks for listening.